Advisor is a budgetless critical theory free school that was initiated by Ann Johal, who's here, and Dan Edelman in 2013, which means that it functions on the generosity of the Orr Gallery, currently led by Denise Ryan over here, for allowing us to take over their space on a day that they are not open, and the generosity of our speakers every year, as well as your time as listeners. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that Advisor takes place on the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. In this, I'd also like to just to sit with the privileges that we currently have to work, live, create, think, and speak freely on the territories of peoples who have in the past and continue to have those same privileges taken away from them by settler colonialism, an institutional framework which allows us those same privileges. I'd also like to thank the Orr Gallery again for generously facilitating these events over the years. Ann Johal for his enormous amount of work supporting and organizing this project, as well as Alex Muir, who co-organizes the speakers with myself and Ann, and in addition has been putting together the tech setup for the past couple of years, and the speakers that have donated their time and thought to past and future presentations. Some boring information to impart. The bathroom, if you need it, is right at the end of this hallway. If you continue going, it is the last door on your left. If you need water or to use the facilities, feel free to get up at any time. I'd also like to shamelessly plug the Orr Gallery's upcoming fundraiser. It's a dance-a-thon. If you haven't been aware of it in the past, you can get pledges from friends and family to dance the night away, or you can just come as a participant in the general festivities the night of. There's a website that gives more information about this. It's setadrift.causevox.com, and I'm sure there will be more information circulated by the Orr Gallery upcoming. So I'd like to introduce Sasha Langford today, who's speaking on an atmosphere of certain uncertainty, knowledge, embodiment, and ecology in thick time. Sasha J. Langford is an independent scholar, composer, and musician. Her recent research has considered the visual discourse of the Anthropocene, the placenta as a site of Marxist critique, and the symbolic role of the phi in psychoanalytic practice. Other recent work includes the 2017 essay and hybrid writing collection, Ephemeral Institutions, and performances at the International Noise Conference in Miami, Florida, the End Times Festival of Noise and Experimental Liberation in Brooklyn, New York, and the Lines of Flight Festival of Experimental Music in Dunedin, New Zealand. She currently teaches media history and theory at Columbia College. And I'll let her take it from here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bryn. And thank you also, and Alex, for all your work in organizing this series. Also, thank you to Denise and the Orr Gallery for hosting this event. Yeah, it's a really wonderful series, and I'm really grateful to be able to share work at it. Thank you also for the territorial acknowledgement. I am grateful for, as a settler on this land that I've lived for the vast majority of my life, the way that this land sustains me and has allowed me to live and do my work here. I also want to thank friends of mine who are here. Thank you so much for coming out, and especially Esteban Gonzalez, my partner, for editing support and other kinds of general support. So some of the questions that I'll be thinking about tonight are still new questions for me, so I look forward to comments and thoughts about them, as it's things that I continue to think about. In light of rising ecological threat and the way in which, for the Western world, environmental collapse has taken on an abstract quality, in the 2014 article Weathering, Climate Change, and the Thick Time of Transcorporeality, feminist new materialists Astrid Namanis and Rachel Lowen Walker propose an ethical model of response to climate change based on embodied experience. The authors write, "Like other climate change theorists and activists, we propose to bridge the distance of abstraction by bringing climate change home. We thus also invite our readers to be interpolated into this ecological space-time of a much more expansive home, at once as distant as that melting ice cap and as close as our own skin. We propose that if we can reimagine climate change and the fleshy, damp immediacy of our own embodied existences as intimately imbricated, and begin to understand that the weather and the climate are not phenomena in which we live at all, or climate would be some natural backdrop to our separate human dramas, but are rather of us, in us, through us, we might ignite the intensity of a mobilization of responsivity." Rather than try to foster political response by way of the disembodied terrain of line graphs or sea level rise visualizations, Namanis and Walker suggest that a key part of an ethical politics to conceive of, respond to, relate to, and or inhabit climate change responsibly involves centering the body and its interconnectivity with ecological phenomena. Intentionally not distinguishing between the historical periodicity of climate and the meteorological fluctuation of weather, the authors emphasize the relational and co-produced character of climate events, by which human bodies are immediately constituted through ongoing experiences of temperature, pressure, and atmospheric sensation. Proposing climate change to be thought of as close as our own skin, as, following Karen Barad's terminology, the interactive process of a mutual becoming between humans and environment, the authors consider an inseparability between sensory and meteorological experience. Localizing the unthinkable spatial and temporal scope of climate change within the immediate realm of embodied experience, the authors suggest that when conceived of as close as one's own skin, climate change ceases to be an othered, distant reality, but rather becomes approachable, thinkable, and intimately known. In light of other recent work placing new materialist literature in critical conversation with psychoanalytic theory, and my own ongoing interest in considering what relevance psychoanalysis has for thinking and responding to ecological crisis, for the purposes of this talk, I want to consider Namanis and Walker's ethical propositions of embodiment from a psychoanalytic perspective. To do so, I will focus primarily on two questions. Firstly, in psychoanalytic terms, what would knowing climate change through the body involve and/or imply? Secondly, if the proper ethical response to climate change, according to them, involves thinking with or at the body, what can psychoanalytic accounts of embodiment offer ethical questions of ecology? After outlining Namanis and Walker's argument a bit further, I will approach these two questions from a range of psychoanalytic thought, from looking at Freud's bodily ego to Lacan's ethics to Franz Fanon's psychodynamics of coloniality, to help imagine what some parts of answers to these questions could look like. Ultimately, in doing so, I hope to suggest that by way of such thinkers, a theory of embodiment that takes into account the role of the unconscious can provide crucial information for ethical and in turn ecological questions, or ecological and in turn ethical questions of the present moment. Astrid Namanis and Rachel Lowen Walker, in their work in Weathering, form part of a larger conversation within new materialist discourse concerned with decentering the status of the human subject in order to think ecological problems. Drawing heavily from the work of Karen Barad, Stacey Alamo, and, to a lesser extent, Elizabeth Gross, Nemanice and Walker propose a concept of the body that emphasizes its relation and co-constituted nature with various material and environmental phenomena. Following the commonplace association of being weathered with physical duress, through their concept of weathering, the authors emphasize the volatile and differentially experienced aspects of climate as something which demands to be continuously and repeatedly endured, and whose effects are distributed along gendered and colonial lines. Climate change, as weather, demands to be persevered through, yet it is because of and through the perseverance of it that the body itself is formed. Aiming to collapse the perceived distance between a melting ice cap and skin, for Nemanice and Walker, the body as transcorporeal constitutes an expansive site of porous interaction and environmental collaboration. Against the linear progression of climate change as imagined in data visualizations like the line graph or the optimistic futurity of sustainability discourse, this transcorporeal embodiment can be said to take place within a thick time where any body contains within it a record of meteorological history that displaces ready distinctions between past or future. When climate change is understood not as a collection of scientific data, but as a sunburn, a summer swim, an allergic reaction to pollen, or an adrenaline response to a flood, this can provoke, the authors suggest, a recognition of mutual imbrication that can generate a relation of intensity, that's quoting them, which can allow not just for an affective experience or response, but create the conditions for a mobilization in a political sense. In most respects, Nemanice and Walker's new materialist account of bodies, ethics, and environment, whereby bodies are primarily conceived of as makers, transfer points, and sensors, has little in common with a psychoanalytic notion of the body concerned above all with the specificities of human subjectivity. However, in its concept of the body as a porous site continually reformed by nonlinear and ongoing processes of acclimatization, Nemanice and Walker's argument recalls the discontinuous dialectic between body, self, and social environment pervasive within most psychoanalytic literature. While not the first instance of such a theorization, in the 1925 short essay Notes on the Mystic Writing Pad, Freud imagines in a particularly poetic way the role of time as it takes place in relation to the unconscious. Carefully considering the different parts of a child's magic slate toy that, like a chalkboard, can receive unlimited impressions of writing, Freud notes the palimpsest-like quality of the toy, whereby it is easy to discover the permanent trace of what was written is retained upon the wax slab itself and is legible in suitable lights. Comparing the quality of human memory to artificial memory aids, Freud notes that our mental apparatus accomplishes precisely what devices to aid our memory cannot. It has an unlimited receptive capacity for new perceptions, and nevertheless lays down permanent, even though not unalterable, memory traces of them. While in other instances to be at once permanent and not unalterable might present a contradiction or even a paradox, it is the unique feature of the unconscious that these two characteristics can be sustained at once. The unconscious marks the rift or retroactive dialectic between the fact that that which is written or marked into psychic life cannot be undone, and that it is at once continually prone to revision with any new experience. Like the prior impressions on the mystic writing pad, which imperceptibly influence how future writing takes place, unconscious experience functions as a form of tracing, which continually reforms and reorients the coordinates of conscious life. Yet just as the notes on the mystic writing pad may become legible under suitable lights, similarly, under the illuminating method of a session of psychoanalysis, the elusive material of the unconscious might suddenly become readable. As Freud had already suggested 2 years earlier with his publication of The Ego and the Id and his second topography, the discontinuous and impressionable temporality of psychic life is necessarily immediately connected, intertwined, and inseparable from embodied experience. The ego, Freud insists, is a bodily ego, because bodily surfaces, as topographical extensions of psychic life, so too hold and recover innumerable impressions of experience. Yet, in a seemingly paradoxical manner, there is at once no direct and transparent link between psychic life and the material extensions of the body. Rather, as Gail Salomon writes in her reading of The Bodily Ego, a psychoanalytic conception problematizes the assumption that the material body is unproblematically available to us as a perfectly faithful reflection of the psychic self. Plenitude and fullness, coherence and wholeness, are not only fictive states as far as subjectivity is concerned, but are the very conditions of being that are foreclosed by language and entry into the symbolic realm. Psychoanalysis offers a subject, fragmentary and incomplete, comprised of a body and a psyche. Not only do these two elements not add up to a coherent whole, neither body nor psyche can be properly thought of as whole or complete. Not only does psychic life navigate and maintain the contradiction of being at once timeless and historical, the body, as Salomon suggests, as a seemingly tangible and intelligible surface, does not serve as a linear representation of mental contents. The continuous connection between mind and body is betrayed by the gap between sensuousness and signification, between physicality and social life. Because of language and entry into the symbolic realm, the human body is always excessive to its animal functions, comprised not solely of kinesthetics or tactility, but also of symbolic content. As social beings, then, strangeness and radical exteriority form part of embodied experience, as the body's intimate familiarity is mediated by meaning, meaning that as socially formed necessarily comes from without. Thus, while Nemanis and Walker appeal to the closeness of skin and the body as a home, as a mode to know climate change, whereby human corporeality, quoting them, is inseparable from nature or environment, following Freud and Salomon, a defining feature of a psychoanalytic account of embodiment is rather decisively the fact that the body is not natural. Because of the discrepancy between conscious and unconscious experience, between embodiment and the symbolic world, bodies are not self-evident and wholly legible, but remain a site of contradiction between familiarity and strangeness. Rather than the suggestion of the body as a home, a Freudian account of the bodily ego proposes that the body is an ultimately, to use the direct translation of Freud's unheimlich or uncanny, unhomely site. Within a psychoanalytic reading, the immediacy of our own embodied existences is necessarily mediated by the otherness of language. Direct experience and knowledge are continually formed by that which remains always partly unknowable. Yet while a psychoanalytic understanding of embodiment departs from Nemanis and Walker's primarily mechanistic and material conception of the body, perhaps the significance of the navigation of strangeness and familiarity of the body within a psychoanalytic framework may offer valuable tools for approaching the uncanny terrain that is climate change. Ecological theorists Nora Campbell, Gerard McHugh, and P.J. Ennis sound like they could be talking about the unconscious when they write that part of the problem of knowing climate change is that it is, quote, everywhere and nowhere, present at all levels and yet absent as a distinct thing we can point to. In the 2013 book Hyperobjects, Philosophy and Ecology After the End of the World, philosopher Timothy Morton similarly recalls qualities of the unconscious when he presents a contradiction between how climate change can be known and how it can be physically experienced. When you feel raindrops, you are experiencing climate in some sense. In particular, you are experiencing the climate change known as global warming. But you are never directly experiencing global warming as such. Nowhere in the long list of catastrophic weather events, which will increase as global warming takes off, will you find global warming. But global warming is as real as this sentence. Global warming is not a function of our measuring devices. Yet because it's distributed across the biosphere and beyond, it's very hard to see as a unique entity. And yet, there it is, raining down on us, burning down on us, quaking the earth, spawning gigantic hurricanes. Global warming is an object of which many things are distributed in pieces. The raindrops falling on my head in Northern California. The tsunami that pours through the streets of Japanese towns. The increasing earthquake activity based on changing pressure on the ocean floor. Like the image in a magic eye picture, global warming is real, but it involves a massive, counterintuitive perspective shift to see it. As with Morton's own analogy elsewhere in the same book of talking to the unconscious as a mode of dealing with climate change, as this passage suggests, climate change, despite all the scientific data that exists about it, presents an empirical paradox where when attempted to be approached directly. Perhaps like Freud's suggestion that the suitable lights of a session of analysis are necessary for being able to read the indication of what is retained upon the wax slab of the unconscious, climate change requires a counterintuitive perspective shift in order to become legible. Just as attending to a single verbal expression, symptom, or mode of embodiment might be essential for trying to approach the unconscious, as psychoanalysts do when they listen to and observe their patients, yet any of these one instances would not be in any means give a full account of unconscious dynamics, it similarly remains a contradiction that the immediacy of weather variance, while the only way to announce, encounter, and embrace the direct presence of climate effects concretely, remains a misrepresentation of the longer rhythms of climate. Recalling the ontology of the unconscious that extends beyond what can be consciously apprehended, something particularly well summarized with Lacan's post-Cartesian assertion, I am where I am not. Climate change is, regardless of where it appears to be, it forms part of the consistency of contemporary experience, regardless of the presence or absence of any dramatic manifestations of it that we might encounter in a given place and time. Thus, in Nemenis and Walker's proposition of knowing climate change through the body, a psychoanalytic perspective may suggest that such knowledge cannot be truly achieved by way of any conventional empirical tools. As omnipresent yet linearly unmappable phenomena, the process of attempting to know climate change or know the unconscious as direct experience involves a sideways approach, a perspective shift against normative modes of awareness. Rather than the positivist presence of line graphs, data visualizations, or conscious rationalization, both phenomena demand modes of knowing that attend to information derived from interstitial, negated, or absent indications. Knowing climate change as or through the body involves or suggests in part an attempt to reconcile and work through unknowability, where disparate pieces of evidence may not add up to a coherent whole, regardless of how we may attempt to do so. A psychoanalytic account of embodiment, then, suggests a potential insight into the role and possibilities of knowledge in Nemenis and Walker's proposition. Yet if we consider the ethical role of the unconscious in certain psychoanalytic accounts, a number of further implications for the potential basis for the body as an ethical site can be further explored. Like Nemenis and Walker's claim for the body as an ethical place of ecological response, in Lacan's ethical maxims, do not give up on your desire, and the status of the unconscious is ethical. It is within the realm of the body, and precisely its dynamic of familiarity and strangeness, where questions of principled action emerge. As philosopher John Rashman suggests, what distinguishes Lacanian ethics from a conventional morality is that, quoting him, the aim of the analytic process is not to make moral agents or virtuous persons out of us. Rather, it is to provoke critical reflection about the essentializing assumptions on which prudential ethics have been built. In other words, we could say approaching the unconscious through analysis is ethical not because it will reveal a universal code for how it should be in the world, but rather it allows us to consider the way in which unexamined moral codes and other social structures have determined and constrained our behavior to deprive us of authentic reflection or action. Not giving up on one's desire, or, in other words, taking responsibility for one's own unconscious, means to notice and intervene in the ways in which various forms of socialization have been internalized and limited our experience. Asking not simply the conventional ethical question, what do we do with what we know, but rather, what do we do with what we do not yet know we know, is how we might achieve a form of accountability in our relations with others and in our contributions to the world. Similar once again to Namanis and Walker's ethical status of the body, if the embodied role of the unconscious, particularly expressed by Lacan's use of the neologism par l'être, speaking being, rather than unconscious later on in his career, suggests, we can thus consider how the ethical status Lacan assigns to the unconscious also corresponds to an ethical status of embodiment. Taking responsibility for one's unconscious involves investigating the body, and the way that its gesturality and sensual capabilities have been informed by symbolic and cultural life. But unlike any pre-given moral norm, such an investigation would not have the purpose of normalizing any certain conditions or of adapting or becoming functional within them. Rather, it would refer to an ongoing and continual attempt to develop awareness of the body's adaptation to social codes, so that these forms of adaptation might be noticed, and thus consciously reevaluated or reclaimed. While Freudian and Lacanian theory can illuminate a few aspects of what Namanis and Walker's argument regarding ecology and the body could imply in a psychoanalytic framework, adding, as I've suggested so far, other aspects to the ethics and forms of knowing of which Namanis and Walker imagine, I want to now turn to a third theorist within psychoanalytic thought, the anti-colonial psychiatrist and philosopher Frantz Fanon, who offers another significant historical materialist dimension of how a psychoanalytic account of embodiment might pertain to an ecological ethics. Like for Freud and Lacan, for Fanon, embodiment concerns a problem of a rift between sensuality and signification, between physical experiential capacities and the symbolic material imposed onto these capacities by the social world. However, for Fanon, this gap concerns not an essential problem of language and bodies, of a generalized notion of bodies as such, but specifically of the coercive and overdetermining logic of racialization within the colonial dynamic. Unlike the individualized, non-linear temporality of the unconscious within European psychoanalysis, Fanon considers the temporal formation of colonial history as that which informs and interrupts possibilities of embodiment, where psychic space forms a key part of colonial occupation. For Fanon, the body schema is also necessarily a historical racial schema, because of the way in which white supremacy conditions the possibilities of inhabiting a body differently according to one's imposed role within a colonial context. Within the role that unresolved unconscious material serves in sustaining colonial relations, for Fanon, a key aspect is the matter of identification. As Dene scholar Glenn Coulthard writes in his reworking of Fanon for a contemporary Indigenous context, quoting him, the structural problem of colonial recognition identified by Fanon involves the way in which delegated exchanges of recognition repeat and sustain oppressive dynamics of power, whereby the terms of accommodation usually end up being determined by and in the interests of the hegemonic partner in the relationship. The dialectic between the psychic space of the colonizer, the desires, fears, and racialized fantasies, and the psychoaffective attachments to these structurally circumscribed modes of recognition on behalf of the colonized are essential, writes Coulthard following Fanon, in maintaining the economic and political structure of colonial relationships over time. Along with physical brutality and cultural and economic dispossession, it is this occupation of the psyche, this imposed form of identification, which, to quote Homi Bhabha's writing on Fanon, has the violent, contradictory effect of surrounding the body of the colonized and certifying its existence, while at once threatening its dismemberment, that Fanon writes must be challenged in order to fully dismantle colonial power relations. Amidst his vast political praxis, which I can't get into fully here, part of the ethical imperative from a Fanonian conception thus involves the task of unlearning forms of domination down to the most internalized levels. Taking responsibility for one's unconscious, for Fanon, is thus not simply an individualized task, but a cultural one that involves attending to the collective ideological spaces that continue to foster colonial modes of relation and identification. Following Marx's concern for history, Fanon's revolutionary project concerns itself with exploding the temporality of the colonial mode of representation of otherness, and in specifically fostering a temporality in its place that, to quote Kara Keeling, raises the possibility of the impossible within colonial reality, Black liberation. Because of the way in which this colonial mode of representation of otherness collaborates with unconscious mechanisms of desire and identification, it must be attended to alongside and no less than material and economic modes of redress and revolution. In considering Fanon's psychodynamics of colonialism in relation to Nemanice and Walker's ecological ethics, it is clear that Fanon contributes something obviously decisively different than Freud or Lacan to their discussion, which is to say a historical, material, and historical materialist consideration of racialization on psychic and embodied experience. The colonial impacts of climate change, of which Nemanice and Walker aim to account for in their conception of weathering, in dialogue with Fanon, can have their significance understood not solely as part of material effects, but also as pertaining to psychic impacts. Following Fanon, an ecological politics, in order to be fully anti-colonial, would necessarily need to involve the work of dismantling the psychic formations that continue to purport colonial modes of relation. As the effects of climate change constitute, as many scholars have suggested, an ongoing form of colonial violence, in a Fanonian conception, perhaps the space of the unconscious, namely identification, could not be considered separately, but might rather form part of an integral component of confronting ecological collapse in order to ensure that the unconscious realm of psychodynamics that continue to foster the colonial relationships of environmental devastation could be accounted for. Yet, if we go beyond solely the consideration of the colonial effects of climate change and rather consider also the causal connection between colonialism and climate, Fanon's analysis brings further stakes to Nemanice and Walker's argument. Among other scholars who have directly considered the inseparability of climate change and colonialism, Denise Ferrer de Silva most directly suggests the causal relation between white supremacy and warming of the atmosphere, which I think she actually addressed. This article that I'm quoting was part of connected to a talk that she gave here last year as well. Quoting Ferrer de Silva, "The accumulation of greenhouse gases in the troposphere corresponds to, as it is a transformation of, the extensive and intensive extraction of matter from the earth in the form of fossil fuels, soil nutrients to feed crops and livestock, and the human and more than human work that sustains capital. The accumulation of atmospheric gases expresses, is equivalent to, the extent of expropriation and the intensity of the concentration of expropriated internal kinetic energy of lands and labor facilitated by coloniality and raciality. What has been and is extracted through colonial juridic mechanisms and racial symbolic tools, the means of production or the raw materials it uses for accumulation, the internal energy of African slaves and indigenous lands, now exists as the form of global capital. There is a precise correspondence, Ferrer de Silva suggests, between the exploitation of racialized bodies in the form of slave labor and the production of climate conditions, whereby the application of human energy transforms the so-called raw materials of land and resources into ecological outcomes. Just as coloniality has historically depended upon racialized notions of climate, anthropogenic climate has depended upon and been co-created with coloniality. Because of colonial juridic mechanisms and racial symbolic tools as systems of discourse, the energetic matter of the internal energy of African slaves, quoting her again, has been transformed into the material effect of heat within the atmosphere. In light of Ferreira da Silva's analysis, the weathering and weathered bodies of which Namanis and Walker speak are not simply shaped by environmental effects that are distributed according to discursive or ideological structures, namely colonialism, but rather part of what weathering is, in this very literal sense, is the bearing of the weight of discursive formations. If we understand greenhouse gases as having an elemental relation to the transfers of energy from colonial juridic mechanisms and racial symbolic tools, then the oppression of the bodily experiences from effects of climate change are in turn inseparable from the violence of discourse of coloniality and racialization, which have been co-created with these effects. Weathering takes place not because of just any forms of interaction between bodies and history, but specifically involves the history of a certain regime of embodiment, one in which racial symbolic tools have imposed violent forms of designation upon bodies in differential ways. While Fanon is rarely conceived of as an ecological theorist, an understanding of the close relation between climate change and colonialism, between white supremacy and greenhouse gases, in Ferreira da Silva's reading, brings a different, surprising dimension to a different passage from Black Skin, White Masks, where Fanon specifically makes use of a meteorological metaphor to describe the structure of the white gaze. And then the occasion arose where I had to meet the white man's eyes. An unfamiliar weight burdened me. The real world challenged my claims. In the white world, the man of color encounters difficulties in the development of his bodily schema. Consciousness of the body is a solely negating activity. It is a third-person consciousness. The body is surrounded by an atmosphere of certain uncertainty. I know that if I want to smoke, I shall have to reach out my right arm and take the pack of cigarettes lying at the other end of the table. The matches, however, are in the drawer on the left, and I shall have to lean back slightly. And all these movements are made not out of habit, but out of implicit knowledge. In an initial reading of this passage, we could note the way that Fanon reveals the duress of identification within an act as seemingly mundane and simple as reaching for a cigarette. We could also note the way in which this passage communicates his critique of the European psychoanalytic tradition, as he expresses a fragmented, negated embodiment, a being where he is not because of any essential characteristic of his body, but specifically because of what is being imposed upon him and asked of him under the white man's eyes. However, if we permitted an ecological reading of this passage and attend to the choice of the word atmosphere to describe this quotidian expression of a colonial structure, we could ask what this passage also reveals about connections between embodied and environmental forms of domination within a contemporary context. Unlike the more often cited passage from the beginning of the same chapter, in which Fanon reflects upon racist interpolation through the example of a white child addressing him and pointing at him on the train, the comparison here of an encounter with whiteness to an atmosphere of certain uncertainty suggests a dimension of power beyond immediate, visible, or empirical observation. Atmosphere, unlike a pointed finger, has no concretely identifiable locus in space or time. Rather, it attends to something that is by definition diffuse, invisible, and unaddressable. Yet in its varieties of pressure, temperature, and composition of elements, atmosphere has the potential to suffocate. And anticipating the association of anti-Black racism with weather that would later be taken up by Black feminists such as Audre Lorde and Christina Sharp, Finau suggests in this passage that which is at once in flux but nonetheless omnipresent, while remaining so intrinsic to the status quo that it escapes mention for those who do not feel its pressure. In this sense, we can remark that the atmosphere described by Fanon shares characteristics of that certain uncertainty of both contemporary meteorology and of unconscious formations, a contradictory or even paradoxical form of knowing where linear empirical observation proves inadequate. But in considering the inseparability between colonial dynamics and climate history, Fanon's allusion here to atmosphere to describe whiteness also gains a literal rather than solely figurative or descriptive implication. The duress upon the body by weather is not strictly an environmental phenomenon, but a discursive, ideological, and cultural one that follows the dynamic of history in imposing and informing the different ways that bodies may act and live. Climate change can be described as an atmosphere of certain uncertainty, to use his words again, not solely because of the epistemological and scientific quandaries it has elicited, but because it involves the yet to be accounted for and yet to be held accountable consequences of white supremacy. In ways perhaps reminiscent of a contradictory dialectic of identification, the present atmosphere constitutes what is necessary in order to breathe to survive, but in its fluid and invasive movements inside and outside of bodies, it at once compromises with its toxicity. It is these residual traces and sites of contradiction that require approach in responding to environmental threat, so that coloniality's imposition upon embodiment may be something that no one, especially those who have had to weather it the most, are any longer expected to acclimatize to. From a psychoanalytic perspective, bringing a phenomenon like climate change home to the body is no obvious or straightforward task. Yet perhaps bodily experience, as something which, like various sources in psychoanalytic thought in various ways suggests, involves the continual navigation of impossible and sometimes debilitating contradiction, may have something to offer the process of rendering legible the unthinkability of ecological catastrophe. In a time where our bodies are forced to adapt to new forms of environmental conditions being imposed upon them, the ethical question of unlearning and relearning how to exist in a body informed by the navigation of differential and discriminating forms of social meaning and duress, might allow for such threatening surroundings to be most honestly approached and thus begin to heal. Thank you.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I know that you've done a lot of work with like Badiou and ecology, and I was actually thinking that a Badiouian ethics in relation to some of the ethical questions I was talking about could be really interesting as well. I think fantasy. Yes, I mean I have thought about both those things. I think those are probably two of the more common sort of psychoanalytic frameworks that are usually associated with ecological problems, like
the drive for destruction and connections between creating unlivable conditions and how that has been thought psychoanalytically in terms of the death drive. And then in my master's research, something that I was exploring more was closer to, the role of fantasy in terms of how a psychoanalytic theory of fantasy would be relevant for approaching ecological questions, mostly in terms of how ideas about nature are imagined and held onto and sustained. So yes, I do think those two concepts are definitely very, very relevant as well. Yeah. The metaphorizing and the misrepresentation and the discursive structures. Yeah, I think that's tricky. I mean, in this part of what I was doing in the end of the paper is actually thinking about I think metaphor can be really important. And at the end of the paper, I was sort of investigating this idea of what would it mean to read this this passage of Fanon's describing this sort of quotidian event to theorize like psychodynamics of coloniality, and then what seems like a metaphor, not even a metaphor, but just the sort of definition of atmosphere as mood, right? I think, you know, there's no reason why we would believe he's talking about a literal atmosphere necessarily, but I guess in that moment, I was really struck by how, like, what would it mean to make that really literal? So if that's a figuration, what would it mean to make it literal? And I guess I was sort of suggesting, well, I think that in doing that with that particular passage, it actually reveals that, oh, wait, thinking about literal atmosphere as immediately imbricated with colonialism, white supremacy, that's not a metaphor, that's literal, and I think the Ferreira da Silva passage that I was quoting, I think, sort of illustrates that in the most sophisticated way, in this sort of elemental reading that she suggests. So I think that metaphor can be interesting, and I guess in terms of what I was suggesting at the end about discursive structures is in a kind of, in an earlier version of this paper, I was thinking about, I kind of approached this topic initially because I thought I wanted to have a bit more of a critical stance on the certain new materialist accounts of the body and of ecology, and then I realized that it would actually just be more fun to like put certain things in conversation with one another, but I think I had the note about discursive structures in there felt important for me because I think one of the things that I find really unsatisfying about certain new materialist ecological accounts is the way in which signification, ideology, other kinds of discursive structures are really either, yeah, I guess most simply just downplayed in significance. So, and I think for something like climate change, it seems totally depoliticizing to sort of just think about, okay, we have, there's these different material forces interacting with another that are affecting us, when there's, historically speaking, the history of climate change is all about, in certain sense, certain regimes of signification, like colonialism or capitalism. So, I mean, it's obviously too simple to call colonialism and capitalism just a regime of signification, because it's more than that, clearly. But it's also, I think, too simple to sort of imagine climate change as separated from those ideological structures. So those are some thoughts on that. Yeah. Yeah. Hey. Hey.
Super great talk.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I really like what you're doing, sort of thinking about climate change. Yeah, the whole idea that we potentially we know it, sort of not knowing it, or sort of articulating broader historical material relationship to these things, sort of kind of unsettling. But, you know, also unknowable. But anyways, it seems like in a lot of ways, I mean, what's interesting about sort of climate change and the rhetoric around it, and like the politics and the sort of organizing that's happening around it, is like in a weird way, like the environment has become like the new subject of history. And so it's sort of allowing for, like an articulation of different kind of otherwise incommensurable kind of political positions. Because the whole idea of like nature is like there's one nature, there's one earth, right? This sort of thing. It affects all of us, this sort of rhetoric. And often I think that that's, in terms of mobilizing around climate change, that rhetoric is really kind of powerful. This isn't really kind of, I'm not super versed in sort of these conversations that are happening around, just bringing different theoretical perspectives to bear on climate change, what is it? But, I know the Morton book, Ecology Without Nature, it's sort of this, there's this sort of sense that climate politics sort of inherently are kind of like actually re-inscribing and sort of re-centering the human subject. So we are what has produced this sort of catastrophe, and then we will mobilize because there's a sort of like universal pressure towards the universal, right? I'm hearing what you're saying, and in conversations with other kind of critiques, sort of warning against this kind of reification that can happen. But I guess I'm just kind of curious about, just in terms of like organizing around sort of climate change, I guess that's my question. I'm not putting the onus on you to answer that, but that's kind of what's happening, right?
It's, yeah. Yeah, I don't know, there's a lot of interesting thoughts there. When you said the environment as a subject of history, did you mean that like in a Marxist sense, like the environment as a proletary? Okay, okay, well there's a few things there that made me think of. I guess one, just to kind of address the aspects of like the what is to be done question, which obviously I like can't answer all by myself, but I can comment on in terms of how I think this is some of the thought that I'm interested in would be relevant to such a question. I think one of like the most like one aspect that I think of with that, which connects to also what I'm thinking before when I mentioned about fantasy, or in terms of this, reified idea of nature, is just the way I think psychoanalysis does have certain things to offer in regards to different forms of ways that we might choose not to acknowledge certain things, whether that be disavowal or denial or repression or foreclosure. And I mean, more environmental examples of that I think about all the time is like when people like make a big deal about people not putting litter in the garbage. And it's like, I understand that, like, yeah, okay, maybe that's, if it's like that, it makes there to be labor for someone else to clean up the litter. I get that. Or like, I get that realistically it would suck to, you know, it's nice to have a street that doesn't have tons and tons of garbage on it. It makes things like habitable. But I think that just like the idea of like litter and littering is so interesting. And the fact that like, I mean, what the hell is littering? You know, it's like, it's just this sort of like foreclosed space of garbage where like, I don't know, like where the hell, like, is it in Cache Creek? I don't know. Like, where does the, you know, it's not like my like granola bar wrap or whatever. It's definitely not immediately part of me anymore. Or part of my sort of day-to-day interaction or whatever. So I guess that's like one thing I think about is like how unbelievably politicizing and radical it would be if suddenly we didn't, like, we just had, like, there was no, like, we couldn't kind of do that with garbage, for example, garbage just being, you know, one environmental issue out of like many we could consider. But it would be like instant, because it would be so, yeah, it would be so unmanageable. So yeah, exactly. Yeah, which like obviously like Vancouver, like whatever the hell that is not that. I don't know what that is, but I'm not so optimistic about that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's that problem is kind of exactly part of what the theorists who I was engaging with off the top are trying to respond to. Astrid Namanis, who is an ecological theorist and feminist who lives in Australia, and her co-writer who she wrote that article with. I think what they are, I don't know how I feel about what they're saying yet. I kind of just wanted to just look at some certain implications or ways of thinking about it. But I think part of what they are politically proposing is that if sort of bodily experiences of whether pleasurable, unpleasurable, anywhere on that spectrum are more rigorously attended to, that would be something that would necessarily be politicizing. However, I see what you're saying in that how can we actually experience weather if those who have the means to escape weather will continue to do so. And I feel like that's like probably, I don't know, it makes me like nervous and sad, but I feel like that's probably what's going to intensify more and more with climate change, is these sort of like, yeah, when like having air conditioning or not is like not just like a kind of casual thing, but actually really, really dire, and also very, also obviously really political. I know that in Montreal, apparently all the air conditioners of the city, so I heard from a friend, actually raise the temperature of the city by 1 degree in the summer. So there's like, it's interesting how that, like, that, you know, someone's access to that comfort is literally making others, like, others' lives more unbearable. Yeah, so, yeah, I'm not really sure, but I'm concerned, I guess, yeah. Yeah. Hey. Thanks. Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you. What did you, who writes about tidalectics? Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's, I've come across that name before, but I haven't heard about that specifically, and that sounds amazing, and I want to look into that a lot. I think, okay, so the question of body as home and how this sort of idea of familiarity, simultaneous familiarity, strangeness relates to temporality, or this sort of like specific palimpsest like temporality of like something that is, yeah, simultaneously, or using Freud's words again, permanent but not alterable. I can also note that I mean, there was so many in how I approached this, there was like so many, I could have, like, I don't know, there's so many ways I could have approached this, or sort of specific pieces of literature and psychoanalysis that I could have like attended to or used, and like there's lots more I could have looked at, but I think that I really love that the Freud's notes on the mystic writing pad, which is also that an essay that Derrida gets his idea of the trace from, in kind of a reworking of that same essay. I think I just like the idea of like Freud sort of like looking at this children's toy and contemplating it, and it being such a like a simple, I don't know, it being like this really like very like tangible and like quite simple, probably too simple in some ways, but also very approachable way to imagine that like contradictory kind of aspect of the unconscious and time. However, one thing I realized as I was reading this out is there was one, I think, specification is in terms of the palimpsest like quality, at least for Freud and Lacan, the unconscious has the kind of weird splitting, or the contradiction really just emerges not because of the unconscious itself, but because of how we access the unconscious and that split between conscious and unconscious. So the unconscious is without time and is timeless. However, it is because of, it has a historical quality because of how we're able to access it, because of how it, in sort of conscious apprehendable experience, we experience time in a chronological way. So that's part of that tension there. And then in terms of how that connects to strangeness and familiarity of the body, a few things come to mind with that. And there's, I think, a lot of different ways, like a lot of intersections there, a lot of ways that could be approached. I guess one thing that comes to mind for me with linking those two ideas is Lacan's concept of the Mobius strip and other figures in topology that he's really interested in. So the Mobius strip, right? You can like, you run your hand along one edge, and then somehow you end up on the flip side. But it doesn't. It's sort of like is this kind of confusing thing. Even though you can make a Mobius strip easily with just one piece of paper, but it has this sort of like weird thing where you don't know when one side starts and when one side ends. There's this like, I mean, we could say like dialectic, although that almost implies that there's like sort of two separate things entirely, whereas it's really just a kind of weird, difficult to fathom intersection between sort of two different things or those two different sides. It's like, what? How can we separate them? So in terms of one connection between this idea of the body being simultaneously familiar and strange, and sort of a psychic structure having this sort of palimpsest-like quality to it, I think part of what that is because of this sort of impressions on the writing slab, or sort of these like, you know, experience, basically. It's because of the way that experience forms part of us in ways that we partly consciously understand and partly partly unconsciously come to know, that the body has this sort of strange aspect to it that can kind of like, because of the fact that, say, if I, because of a certain way of inhabiting myself at any given moment, a certain association or kind of understanding of myself might like erupt in an unprovoked way that I can't even necessarily understand why. I think that would be like maybe like one aspect. So like, I think the strangeness is necessarily because of this sort of cumulative information that isn't always accessible, or maybe it can only be sort of accessed in these sort of sideways ways. I feel like I could kind of like talk about this question for a long time, so I don't know if I should keep going on, but those are I think that's part of it. I guess one other thing I would say about that is just in terms of like the body is strange, which I find is, I think of like, in the most kind of simple terms, there's actually an essay by Foucault on the utopian body where he just talks about the fact that he can't access, it's not really a psychoanalytic piece, but he's sort of thinking about the body as a utopian site because it has these places on it that he can only imagine but can't sort of directly experience, like the back of his head, for instance. And I think that's it's a really beautiful essay, but I think that has a sort of directly sort of psychoanalytic implication. Okay, so the back of my head, right? A psychoanalytic account might say, at least in a sort of, Freudian or Lacanian notion, would be like, that is strange just because of how it's, you know, right here, and yet there's a kind of limited mode of access. Or same thing with like internal organs, right? They're there, they're functioning, and yet they're me, and yet I have no direct relationship with them at all. Anyway, yeah. Oh. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Thank you. I mean, I guess I could answer that question. I guess my best answer to that question, how I would connect the Anthropocene or thinking about the Anthropocene to music, I guess I could just talk about one recent project that I did, which was for a residency at the Media Arts Committee at Co-op Radio, and it was under the theme of climate studies. And for that, something that I was thinking about, or something I knew going into it, is that I wanted to work with the earthquake drill recordings that get played in public institutions in the Lower Mainland, that growing up in Vancouver, I had to listen to like a lot in elementary school, high school, but still I have to like, I hear them like at my work too, like when we do earthquake drills. So I thought that was earthquakes being something that, among other things, get more intensified with climate change, and but also have this, I think in this, I guess I was interested in the auditory dimensions of these drills, which some of them are just instructions, but some of them also just have this earthquake sound effect that's supposed to simulate the earthquake experience, which I was also interested in researching the history of, but I didn't get too much into that. But yeah, what I actually ultimately ended up doing is using those drills, but then sort of repurposing them with actually recordings of house demolitions in Vancouver, because I was sort of thinking a bit about, okay, well, how can we think about a sort of catastrophe of demolition in this region without also thinking about, okay, wait, like my house might be demolished like this year, and that is something, and same with my friends, right? That is like a sort of collective circumstance of displacement that is in some ways more pressing than like sort of like the big one or this big earthquake. So I guess that is like one way in which I've sort of thought some aspects of the Anthropocene with in relation to music. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of interesting projects like that. Of I mean, one for that same residency, one another project that I found particularly interesting is Stacey Ho did a recording of people talking about weather. It was just like a sound recording of like different people that I think she just ran into on Commercial Drive, talking about like childhood experiences of weather and current experiences of weather and how those were different. And I thought that was really I don't know if that piece maybe could work well in other forms too, but definitely something about the auditory aspect of storytelling and listening to a story and then that being about the weather experiences was also pretty interesting, like use of sound for a ecological project like that. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Thank you so much, Sasha.
Thank you.